Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, the Nature Restoration Law. What is in it? What is not in it? We're on farms in the north, the west, the south and the Midlands. And with all the details to be worked out, we'll get expert opinion on how that might shape up. So yes, we're going to look at the Nature Restoration Law in the round this morning and see, is it an opportunity for landowners and for the natural world, or a burden and yet another set of national targets that we might miss? But because it chopped and it changed so many times during its incredibly lengthy birth, we can't do any of that without first finding out what measures are still in it and what got sacrificed along the way to get it over the line. So Hannah Quinn Mulligan has been poring over it all night long. Hannah, tell us, please, where on land, sea and air does this law seek to restore nature, and by how much?
So it does an awful lot for nature. So it sets legally binding targets in place, not just for land, sea and air, but for seven specific ecosystems. But the ones you mentioned are the ones that are going to be assessed and have evidence based around them. For Ireland, the biggest concern is the land one, and definitely in terms of re-wetting, there's been an awful lot. Technically, by 2030, at least 30% of the total area of all habitat types in Ireland that are not in good condition must be brought into good condition. And our plan, our national plan, has to be in place by 2026.
So in the next 2 years, we have to set a baseline that establishes how degraded ecosystems are, and then we have to devise schemes for landowners to buy into that will reverse that degradation. And that all has to be worked out by August 2026. Now, roll up your sleeves for us there, please, and get stuck into the most contentious part of this. Rewetting. What are we going to have to do?
So I guess importantly to say, first of all, is that re-wetting is going to be completely voluntary for farmers and landowners. And that's been reiterated by our Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConlogue, and also the European Commissioner as well. A target for re-wetting has also been reduced substantially for Ireland. So originally it was 332,900 hectares. That's nearly been halved to 141,000 hectares. And another point that should be made is that Bord na Mona already aims to re-wet an awful lot of peatland, 33,000 hectares. That will actually cover Ireland up until 2035. So we'll still have targets to reach by 2050, but actually our target for up to 2035 will be covered by re-wetting the Bord na Mona already planned peatland.
And read back to me that key line that is in the text of the law regarding re-wetting.
So verbatim, it says that to re-wet does not imply an obligation for farmers and private landowners to re-wet their land, for whom re-wetting on agricultural land remains voluntary.
Re-wetting on agricultural land remains voluntary. So that's not a policy that can change with a change of government. That is a line that is in the law. Let's talk about money, though, Hannah. Is there money to support farmers and others who could see a change in their land use?
Yes, there is. And any rewetting scheme would have to be very attractive to farmers and landowners. President Higgins has also signed a bill into law this week that it will provide €3.15 billion in funding to support measures included under the Nature Restoration Law. But it's important to say that this is just a once-off lump sum, so that different revenue streams would have to be found for long-running rewetting schemes or permanent compensation for land change where it's needed. And that fund is going to be overseen by the National Parks and Wildlife Service, but of course they'll be bringing on board the Department of Ag, the Department of Climate Action, and also stakeholders, including farm lobby groups.
Yeah, that is an important distinction. It is capital funding, that 3.15. It's not current spending. But what of a farmer's cap payments? Are they going to be affected?
No. Straight out, no, they will not be affected at all. And that's been assured, and not just again by our own Minister of Agriculture, but also the Commissioner in Brussels. A farmer can receive their cap payments and potentially then additional payments through other schemes that are introduced. And both farm organisations and the Green Movement across Europe are calling for a new restoration fund for landowners to support these changes. And interestingly, a lot of farmers out there might not know, the National Parks and Wildlife Service already has a farm plan scheme, which is very similar to the Burn Bio project and being highly individualised for each farm. And there's a maximum payment there of up to €10,000 per farmer per year. But up until now, they've been limited in rolling that out due to lack of funding.
Indeed, it could be a template for the Nature Restoration Fund. Tell me, though, is this going to end up being an uplands thing? Will only farmers in marginal land areas have to take measures under the Nature Restoration Law? And are the Hannah Quinn Mulligans of the world going to be free to continue doing as you do?
I have boggy land too. Limerick isn't free of bog. I wish it were. But no, that is a complaint against it. And a lot of farmers in marginal land are very concerned about that. What's been said to me is that it's going to be an all-island approach in terms of the Republic of Ireland anyway. So what was put to me was that there are otters on the River Dodder and there's otters in the River Liffey. And what has to be discovered is a way to build a nature corridor between those. And that would include farmers, landowners, but also people in cities. That's a really important key part. And actually in the Nature Restoration Law as well, there's an Article 8 and that covers cities. So it's everyone that is going to be involved. And it definitely will not just be farmers in the west of Ireland. Farmers in the east of Ireland are going to have to look at pollinators. They're going to have to look at hedgerows. They're potentially going to have to look at other areas like that.
Okay, Hannah, thanks very much for that. Now, there is no point in saying that there isn't going to be resistance to the Nature Restoration Law, because obviously there's a deep well of mistrust to be overcome in persuading some farmers that this is not just going to tie their hands. The president of the Irish Natura and Hill Farmers Association said the Nature Restoration Law was, quote, a dark day for democracy. The vice president of that organisation is Micheál MacDonald, a hill farmer in Erith County Mayo. Ella McSweeney met him on his farm to hear his concerns about the new law.
Toby. Just turning the sheep over now here, I'm just going to get them over here before I get into the field here now, so he'll bring them over to me. If he's feeling good, sometimes he's a bit like a man after a drink, he decides to pack it in halfway through. It's Blackface Mountain, all Blackface Mountain, so Mayo Blackface, really, and they're crossed in. There's some Suffolks on them because they'll all be sold off at stores, the whole lot of them. But any Blackface Mountain then will be kept as replacements. We're basically a hill farm with a very small amount of enclosed land. All our commonage land is designated, every single last yard of it, and a lot of our inset land is designated as well.
And we're walking along the lower parts of your land, and this land is peaty soils. It was reclaimed by your father, yeah. Is that right?
Yes, the father, and we all helped out for to reclaim this land because we were there was incentives given there by the government and by Chacosc and other for to do this. So I suppose we followed government guidelines and we met the criteria, and there was monies there for to reclaim those lands and make them into better land so that the farm could be more sustainable, could give you better advantages in managing how the hill was managed as well.
So when you hear about the Nature Restoration Law and it is essentially trying to take places like this and restore them.
Yes.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I find it very, very, I suppose it's emotional, but it also makes you very cross that, you know what I mean, that somebody is going to implement on you something, infringe on your property rights, you know what I mean. But it's also what it's doing is taking away your livelihood, really, because I won't be able to draw cap payments on this land. It has now been changed. The land type has now been changed from agricultural to ecological. You look up at those hills here, all those hills. They're all Annex 1 habitats. Within the Nature Restoration Law, it says Annex 1 habitats has to be recognised as ecological areas. The land use has now been changed from agriculture to ecological.
And yet the government has said very clearly that that will not be the case. You will still be able to get your cap payments, that the Nature Restoration Law will come with a nature fund that will be separate from that.
Yeah, but the nature fund that they have highlighted within Ireland at the minute, they're saying that this €3.5 billion going to be available from 26 on. But my understanding of that and from reading into it is that that's for capital projects, for the likes of Border Monoculture, for the rewet projects, and that land and that money will be used up. So we have huge amount of uncertainty. And you know what I mean? Uncertainty is causing to confusion, and it's also causing anger among farmers that they don't know what their livelihoods are. Like we've seen with Chagas with the small farm surveys that 80% of the farmers along the West Coast rely 110% on a cap payment. It's huge. It's hugely beneficial. If that's gone, we're gone. And we've seen what's happened with the designations, with the Habitats Directive back in 98. They designated this land, like 15% of the land area was designated. We say that you've got an acre garden at home, and you say, OK, you know what, I'm going to fence off half it, and I'm going to have trees in one half, and I'm going to have a little bit of spot for my pony in the other half. And it's designated land, and you say, hold on, sorry, you cannot do that. You need to do an environmental impact assessment on what that fencing would be. You cannot put up a fence there because you cannot pierce the ground. Those are all actions required and consent. You want to change your breed in your garden from black-faced sheep to Suffolk sheep, you cannot do it because it's an action required and consent from the government in order to do so. This is what happened, and we're farming here under 38 actions required and consent. If I want to open that drain there tomorrow, I've got to get consent from the MPWS to do it.
And what is that legacy left with you?
Lack of trust. You know what I mean? Lack of trust. It's also a huge financial burden. The designations have been there for the last 25 years and they're saying that the habitats have not improved. So like that is under the guidance of putting the designation on. So it's time to stop and say, let's work with the farmer here. Let's work with the farmer to try and make this happen.
Toby, come on.
At the end of the day, governments will come and go, but farmers are here. It's vitally important that the farmers' views are taken on board.
So do you want to have a relocalisation for Dublin to cede control, if you like, to local areas and give much more control to local areas managing the future of the Nature Restoration Fund, as it will be, for farmers like yourself?
Totally, like, you know what I mean? I think that we've seen it with the actual EIPs that like once the actual issues are locally driven and local input, you get a lot of bit buyer in from farmers. You know, so it's vitally important that the local issues are that the farmers locally have the local responsibility for the future and the implementation of this law. You know, I mean, history has shown us that, you know what I mean, that implementation of it, once they slap on the designation, slap in the Nature Restoration Law, they potentially could say it's now law, we don't need to give you money at all. Tough luck.
The Erith River here on the border of your land, is it?
Yeah, this is the Erith River. It flows right through it, right all the way along. It rises back there in the Drummond Mountains, and there's also a tributary that flows out of the Parfrey Mountains as well. So it's a salmon river.
You see the salmon?
Over the last number of years, it hasn't been as good for fishing it as it was previous to that, but it's... Even in the winter time, you see, if we were standing here, you can see where the fish... You can actually physically see the fish spawning. So, yeah, it's... It's a nice tranquil place for to come in and sit and relax and think about life.
At the heart of this, Micheál, is a very strong sense I'm getting from you that you do not trust what the government is telling you.
Well, I suppose I cannot, because, you know, history has shown us that that the trust factor, that there's an issue with it. And I suppose the designations are a prime example of that. I'm not here for to tell you that I'm an ecological hero, but what I am here to tell you is that we will manage those lands, and we have managed those lands in a positive way for the environment and for ecological services and environmental services as well.
It is law now. There are 2 years for the Irish government to come up with a plan. What needs to happen, do you think?
The number one key point that that has to happen is that those lands remain eligible for cap payments, that there's a defined fund for a transition. Holding those lands as agricultural areas is vitally important, and cap funding still to be drawn down on them, because that's what the farmers around here rely on, is 100% cap funding. It's what's keeping those areas going. Whether we have to tweak it a little bit, fine, this way and that way, but like it's vitally important that the farmers' views are taken on board.
Micheál MacDonald of the INHFA talking to Ella on the banks of the Erith River there. Now, Dr. Brendan Dunford has been listening to that. Brendan's not involved in devising this nature restoration plan, but he does have considerable experience in the burden of persuading farmers to get involved in high nature value farming. Good morning, Brendan. Obviously, there's an awful lot of trust that needs to be re-established there. What's your advice to government?
Yeah, it's a really interesting piece, actually, listen to Micheál there, and I find myself agreeing with a lot of what he said. And I think trust, Philip, as you know, is earned. It's not something you just have. It's earned. It's hard to earn it, and it's easily lost. And I think that's a lesson for government, I think. But just three points that Micheál made, I think that speak to me. One is that, like, he really does love his nature. Just listening to him by the stream there is lovely. And that's a lot of farmers do. And I think fundamentally the nature conservation law is about looking after nature. I think most people can subscribe to that. The second point, I think, which is really interesting, about is about the ARCs. And, you know, if you're in an SSE, for instance, you need a lot of support to do anything because so much paperwork involved. And of course, farmers hate paperwork like we all do. And I do think we need to have local supports to help farmers get through that. It shouldn't be a burden on them at all. It should be a celebration that they're living and farming in these areas. I think the third thing that Michael said, and this is where the trust comes in, I think keeping it local. I think the biggest success stories, I think, in conservation on farmland in recent years have been the likes of the Burren, the Danube EIP, the Pollinators EIP. They've all been local. They've all been scientists working with farmers, working with the policy people, working with local authorities to come up with a solution for their area. And you can't beat sitting around the table, talking to people face to face to establish trust and to build relationships. And, you know, that's where it comes from. There's no easy answer. It does take time. It does take sitting down. It does take compromise. It does take a lot of practice. It does take a lot of deep listening. But it can be done. And I'm very confident that farmers can deliver.
Okay, that's a good start to the conversation. Stay with us, Brendan. Of course, there's a diversity of opinion here. Not all farmer reaction to the nature restoration law has been negative. After this break, we're going to hear from an enthusiastic supporter.
Email countrywide at rte.ie.
We're all about the nature restoration law this morning, and of course there's a diverse range of attitudes amongst farmers towards it. At the other end of the spectrum from the opinion that Ella just heard in the West, I travelled to Limerick to talk to Gerard Marr, who supports what the law is trying to achieve. So right now, you're probably expecting to hear some niche organic producer, but Garrod actually runs an award-winning, conventional, very profitable, medium-sized dairy operation. He has just found ways to do so while making room for nature.
Very, very big mix of grasses here, don't you?
Mm. How did you achieve that now?
Doing nothing. That's how that happened. This field hasn't got any input in, I'd say, 7 or 8 years. We haven't even spread lime in it.
No slurry, no fertiliser,
nothing. No, we take one cut of hay off it.
There's a hidden field at the back of Garrod's farm, one that he does little with except take a cut of fodder in the midsummer. Otherwise, nature more or less takes its own course here.
I purposely ran it out to see what would it grow.
Are you happy with the way that it's turned out?
I am, because you can see yourself the amount of butterflies and everything that's here.
Buttercup, thistle, oxide daisies.
There's ragged robin. There's a lot here, like plants that you wouldn't that I wouldn't think would be here, are here, like so.
Have you any thoughts on this nature restoration law?
You'd be shot for saying it, but yeah, I'm in favour for it. To be honest, I'm in favour.
So why would you say you'd be shot for saying it?
Because you would have a percentage of farmers that would be opposed to it. There's no point in saying you wouldn't.
Do you think that they know what they're actually opposed to?
This is the problem. This is it, like. And even to say, I don't even know what I'm agreeing to, because nobody knows, like.
Gerard is no tree-hugging hippie. He runs a profitable, intensive dairy operation, milking 110 British Frisians. When he graduated from Ag College, he got down to work turning the place into a textbook operation.
I was out with my sprayer and I was spraying along, and I came to a corner and it was full of thistles. And I remember just seeing the amount of butterflies that were on that corner of thistles. Like, it was, nothing I've ever seen before. It was amazing, all different colours. I looked around, there was nowhere else from. There wasn't a thistle to be seen anywhere else. And I just turned off my sprayer and never turned it on since. That was a couple of years ago, so.
We pass a firebreak for overhead wires passing between two stands of forestry. He's let the nettles and thistles here grow to chest height, where others would have them cut right back.
I see a pocket of nature. I was a big fan of Grazer 90 before, and Grazer 90 will kill everything you see there before, except the grass.
It's stone dead, yeah.
Yeah.
Grazon 90 is strong it's measured in millilitres you portion it out. Yeah,
so I was a big fan of that and we'd have the place pristine. But I felt that the amount of time that I was spending doing it and the amount of time and money it was costing, because that's a dear product. It only comes in a litre size. All this work and no return for it. So we really just focused on what was actually making us money, what was actually turning the profit. And all that work and time that was going into keeping the place spick and span was actually time-consuming for me.
You had better things to be doing.
Yeah, like I've two daughters. The eldest is five and the other one is nearly two. And we have another one on the way. So, and both my parents died relatively young, so...
Would they rather see you standing on the side of a pitch or see the back of your head as you're spraying nettles?
Exactly. And to me, life is so short, I felt that, sure, look, all you're doing is fighting nature, and nature keeps finding a way. So I kind of said to hell with it.
Despite his unconventional approach, the milk that he's producing meant that he was in contention for a National Dairy Council award. But when the judges came to visit his farm, Giraud was afraid that what he was doing would seem just a little bit too out there.
I know what they're looking for, and what I had wasn't what they were looking for. And I was very close to spraying my fields and getting rid of any weeds that were there and trimming my hedges and...
Just to conform.
Yeah, just to have what they were looking for, because that's have the aesthetics. So I said, you know what, no, I won't, and we'll just see how we get on. And I could see the lads looking at it, and they were kind of humming and hawing. I just drew their attention to it, and I said, look, I said, I don't like it either, but what are your thoughts on it? And these were three highly regarded judges within the industry that would know their stuff and do know their stuff. And I just says to him, well, if he can't accept it, how are we going to get everyone else to accept it?
Mm-hmm.
And I knew then, it was like doing a driving test. I knew I'd failed at that point, that I wasn't in.
Okay, but where did the conversation go after that?
Well, I made my point. I made my case. I said, look, it's not affecting the profitability of the herd. I said, we're a very productive herd, or else he wouldn't be here. And I said, we're showing that the herd can achieve what the top herds in the country are doing.
And it doesn't have to look like everywhere else.
Yeah, and I said, you know, the proof is in the pudding, the fact that you're here. Long story short, anyway, when it came to the awards, they actually gave me a prize. They gave me a Working with Nature award, which was never there before. But I just felt that they had no argument. They couldn't say I was wrong. If anything, they knew I was right.
The watchword in this field really seems to be just don't get in the way, let nature do its thing.
Like, you could turn around here and spray all this off and reseed it all, produce top quality silage, but then you could end up finding yourself milking more cows to eat that silage. Having more cows in adds another 20 minutes, 30 minutes onto your day, and you know, time is precious and life is short.
And then you have a field that you can come down and you can watch the swallows dancing over the top of the grass there, because there must be great insect life for them in here.
Yeah. Like, look, it's the furthest away field on the farm, so I kind of felt that this is our effort for the nature restoration.
Be honest with me, this is actually your man shed. This is your quiet little space that nobody follows you down to, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's a field nobody sees either.
Yeah. You could just be lying on the flat of your back here.
Yeah.
Giraud Marr in Limerick. And listening to that is Dr. Catherine Farrell, a botanist in Trinity College Dublin, whose area of expertise is in restoration ecology. Catherine, is there a way of monetizing what Giraud is doing there so that farmers can be paid for making the farm a little bit less commercially productive but a little bit more nature friendly?
Absolutely. And I think there's already ways, and a lot of that work was piloted by Brendan and championed in the Burn Life program, where for the first time farmers were paid for habitat quality. So it's when we were listening to Garrod there, you could just hear the bees, you could hear the sounds of nature. And really, instead of fighting with nature and working with nature, he has delivered a multiple of co-benefits, benefits for nature, benefits in terms of milk production and profitability. He hasn't lost any of that. And importantly, we often just focus on, the nature side. But when he talked there about having more time with his family, so healthy farmers mean healthy farms. And so you can see the mutual benefits there. So there are ways of paying for habitat quality. And then the next thing is to develop ways of payments for ecosystem services. So what he is delivering there, we describe as ecosystem services. So they're services that we can't live without.
And how, Catherine, do we get the private sector involved in that? Is there a way of leveraging money out of them for what Garrod is doing?
Absolutely, there is a way. So businesses have, huge risks. So lots of businesses rely on nature. So KPMG published a report last December that said that over 50% of businesses in Ireland rely on nature. And I would say that that is, a very kind of limited view. There's probably a lot more if you dig deeper. So businesses need to invest in nature to make sure that they continue to get the returns. And so we know that we have some public funds available. We know that we'll have some money coming from the EU. And we also know we're going to need money from the private side. So at the moment in Trinity, we're piloting approaches where we can leverage funding from businesses to invest in farms like Garrod's so that we can matchmake businesses with farmers.
Okay.
To ensure that we get returns for nature.
I'm going to commit now to having a detailed look under the hood at what that might look like in another programme down the line. But I want to move on right now to another area that I know is a specific interest of yours, and that is re-wetting, which has of course proven to be the most contentious aspect of the nature restoration law. But perhaps those fears were more apparent than real. We still don't have many examples of farms that have voluntarily re-wet peaty farmland where we can see how much farming can continue once the water table has been raised. But a year ago, I visited one farm near Forban in Offaly where Adrian Egan and his father Kieran were raising the water table by blocking drains and ditches. I went back to see what had happened on Thursday.
Now just watch your step here because it's a bit soft.
It's a lot more firm underfoot than I remember it from over really? A year ago, though.
Really, yeah. That's the weather, though, as well. It's been so dry that even the ground up on the farm above is so hard. It's like a rock.
You had just started raising the water table the last time that I was here. Really? How high is it now?
It's lower, if anything, at the minute because the weather has been so dry.
The ground is undulating, so there isn't a uniform answer. But a year ago, open drains meant that the water table was well over a metre below the surface. Now that the drains have been blocked and the water has risen, it is up between 30 and 40 centimetres from the surface.
It's not getting anything the last few weeks, so it's actually dropped, if anything.
What happened, though, in the great perma rain of 2023-24?
Funnily enough, the rain, it wasn't as wet as other parts of the bog. If anything, we crops and grasses and different things grown in it, it actually absorbed it better. So like say before this when we were cutting turf and there was no plants here at all, it was just peat. You wouldn't come in here because you'd sink. By raising the water table you're giving plants a chance to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And when the plants grow they give the soil structure. And that's what holds the soil together.
You could walk over those areas that had been re-wetted where there was a skin of vegetation on the top, but the other areas of bog that hadn't been re-wetted in all of that rain, you wouldn't go in there even in waders, never mind wellies.
No, you would not. No, even recently, there's fellas cutting turf over here. Now, the year that was in last year was such a wet year. He was saying that the bog was so wet but it's not as bad on this side as it is over there.
The areas that are still being drained were wetter. The area that was being re-wet was firmer underfoot.
Exactly, because and that's all down to the plants growing in it.
Okay, so explain this piece of kit to me.
Right, so there's the... You just have to see where it's at.
Scientist Sebastian Mulliman is out on the bog when I visit conducting an experiment. He wants to see what impact livestock would have on the re-wetted areas if they were turned out here now. Basically, would they sink or is the ground firm enough to support them?
Measure what the depth is. So right now it's at zero, right? It's just on the ground, it's at zero. And then I'll lift it up to the top of this tube.
And what is that? Is that an iron weight or a stainless steel weight?
Stainless steel. Yeah.
How much of...
He drops a metal weight inside a piece of wavin pipe to simulate a cow walking over the land and measure how deep the weight sinks.
Okay. Let's see what happens. And now it's how deep?
1 centimetre deep.
So that made a... Your average small to light animal, are we talking about, or
no,
is this a heavy animal?
No, this is a cow.
This is meant to simulate a cow, okay?
Yeah.
Would only make an impression of 1 centimetre with each footprint?
Yeah.
Which is, I assume, sustainable in most landscapes, is it?
Yes, I think it's considered all right for your sward. You won't churn it up, you won't get big black patches, you won't damage your grass too much.
By contrast, the same exercise done on parts of the bog that are still being drained, not yet re-wetted, and the stainless steel weight sinks 6 or 7 centimetres. You wouldn't turn anything out on it.
Kieran, how much more confident would you be about turning out animals on this land now and them not sinking in it?
This is actually surprising me, myself, that it's as firm as it is. Because when that was sowed, it wasn't.
What month do you think you could have turned animals out here?
Oh, you could turn them out in April, May. Definitely, yeah. And then, depending on how long...
Kieran Egan, Adrian's dad, used to drain this land so that he could graze cattle there. Now he's left feeling that draining was the wrong approach to take.
How much of a surprise is that to you?
Well, it's a surprise, the fact that it is as firm as it is.
Did you ever think 10 years ago that this is a spot that would have been grazable in April?
I wouldn't have thought it under a re-wetting scheme. Hmm. I would have been going the opposite way. I would have been draining the bog, which I was doing to get grass out here further. But the fact that it can be done raising the water table is a surprise to me. Do you know what I mean?
Not just to you. I mean, it's completely counterintuitive, isn't it? Everything that you would think makes sense.
Yeah, but as I say, I say to people, I spent my lifetime draining this land to grow grass. And because of Adrian getting involved in the scheme, they do the opposite. It was hard to get my head around it, that this will work. Mm. And it is.
Proof of the pudding, though.
Yeah.
Kieran Egan in Offaly. Catherine Farrell has been listening to that. She has a lot of hands-on experience of re-wetting bogs. Catherine, what's true for the Egan farm might not be, in fact, won't be true for everywhere else. But clearly, the main takeaway from this needs to be that raising the water table does not mean flooding the land.
No, not at all. So in that instance, and it was absolutely fascinating listening to it, you know, you're walking... the proof was in the pudding. So Kieran, who has drained this farm all his life, seeing now that this is actually better for grazing his animals by raising the water table. So, you know, there's a bit of a misnomer about this word re-wetting. So in essence, you're really just raising the water table by 10 to 20 centimetres. And what that delivers are co-benefits from the carbon emissions. But also those wetland species are able to hold that soil better together. So this is another clear example of working with nature, using the species that can live and thrive in these lands, that can then hold the soil together, hold water as well, and actually alleviate flooding. So all of this work is actually going to counteract flooding. So we need land that can hold water better, And any land downstream of that farm is going to get all the benefits of, you know, Kieran and Adrian working together for nature.
Indeed, I would be here all day if I was to start trying to list off the plants, the insects and the birds that I saw on that short visit to the Egan farm just outside Forbann. I want to move on, though, because all through the summer months, farmers with an interest in nature will be crisscrossing between Leitrim and Fermanagh, exploring each other's farms in the company of other farmers and artists. It's organised by Leitrim County Council and the Dock Arts Centre and funded through the Creative Ireland Shared Island Fund. Now, one of the participating farmers is Patrick McGurn, who lives on the shores of Lough Erne and is well known to farms Air Nilon Aran. Through his work on nature on the islands, he's a man so taken by hay meadows that he did a PhD on them. Early one morning, Ella McSweeney and Patrick set out on a ramble over his land.
I know it is a very sunny morning, but it's kind of like paradise here.
It is, yeah. It's a lovely spot.
Isn't
it?
It
really is a lovely spot.
Just describe where we are.
We're in Portnoid Caoch, which is in County Fermanagh, and we run a beef suckler farm with about 15 cows. But we run it both to make a profit, but with nature in mind, because that's my interest. So we have a lot of species-rich grassland, lowland raised bogs with things like snipe on it, you know, good birds. We've got flowers indicative of particular habitats.
And if we just stop for a second, we're on a very beautiful little laneway. We'll just listen to the birds for 1 second, and you can hear the amount of nature around us. What breed of cattle do you keep?
They're mainly Angus based, but we cross with a Simmental bull then. And then we sell the bull calves in the autumn time, maybe December, once they're eating meal and eating silage.
We've walked down from your house, down a really lovely grassy laneway with hedgerows either side. And as we were walking, kind of walking through clouds of insects, and there's lots of butterflies there in the sunlight, and then we've come here to the shores of Lough Erne.
The lock was dropped in the, I think it was in late 40s, early 50s, so some of the islands came when the lock was dropped. So this woodland that you're seeing here along the lock shore would have been the original foreshore, and then when Ballyshannon put up the dam, the lock was actually dropped.
So this woodland should be underwater, is that what you mean?
Originally it would have been underwater, and in fact some of those islands would have come up once the lock was dropped.
It must have been amazing for local people to suddenly see islands.
It must have been, yes.
Yeah, it must have been.
And then they all got an extra bit of shore then. Some of that which became very good breeding wader land as well, you know, for breeding waders.
The Erne waterway links you to the Shannon, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Yeah, you can leave here and go to Leitrim. Limerick, if you have time, you can go to Leitrim on the way too. I've done the Leitrim, but not the Limerick.
What made you put pathways through the farm?
I liked walking this way, and it was partly a COVID project as well when it was off. You know, I had much work, so I wheeled the pathways in.
Has it changed the way that you think about the farm and manage it?
Well, I find things, just I see things on the farm, like the crab, the tree, the apple tree, some plants I come across that I hadn't seen before. And you go through, now we're entering a field.
Little gate here.
This field is an example of a species-rich field, very high in biodiversity. A very productive field from a biodiversity point of view. That production is dependent on agricultural grazing. So if we don't graze this field, it'll shrub up. And I spend more time in these fields trying to keep them right than the improved grasslands that will go in later.
So sorry, if you don't graze them...
If they don't graze them, okay. The reason these have been grasslands so long that we have on this field here with the mass fritillary butterfly. On the farm, we've recorded 19 different butterflies. And if you take the number of butterflies in Ireland, it's 26 or something to know. So that's quite high.
What other plants do you
have?
Well,
if we walk up here, see the different plants up this end of it. The first plant that we see standing here is meadow thistle. It's not prickly. It's purple, yeah, and it's the indicator for this type of grassland. It's known as Millennia Meadows or Fen Meadow, and it's called. It's very heavy clay soil. The other indicator species is Devil's Bit Scabious, which doesn't flower until September.
Devilsbit scabious is the feed source for the marsh fritillary butterfly, which is a very important rare butterfly, and it is on this field.
The cattle, so what is the regime of grazing here?
I will likely turn a larger number of stock out on this for a short period. Now, to be fair, they don't overlike it. They prefer the improved perennial ryegrass, which is what we have in reseeded fields and dairy farms on our silage land, is bred to have a high sugar content, so it's sweeter.
But when you put them in, how are you seeing that they don't like it?
They come to the gate to try to get back out into the other field. Simple as that. So I might put heifers down here. You can see that meadow thistle all through it.
Thank you.
As a farmer, I would get more out of this if I put a bit of fertiliser on it. And I don't get paid for biodiversity. Do you know, I get paid for the produce. So if we as a society want to keep these species-rich meadows, how do you do it in a farming situation where it's not economic?
Do you do it?
I do it because it's my interest, you know, and it's part of the farm. It's just I like it as the farm. But I'm quite happy and I'm in a position that I work out as well. So I don't have to push every inch of land where some farmers who don't work out might have to try to get more out of the land to justify it. We'll just take a walk down this way. This is it's a bit easier to walk over here. As you can see, the very heavy clay soil.
Yeah.
And like this is the funnel for the cattle.
I mean, you look like you could scoop that out and make pottery out of it.
This is where I dig the pottery out for my sister.
Horses there.
The piebald's Johnny Cash. The other two we're just grazing them for a while.
So two white horses and one white and black.
Connemara ponies.
And then the cattle here.
The cattle are where we'll see them.
Underneath the trees, which is fair enough because it's so hot.
Yeah, a bit of shade is important. Yeah,
and then nibbling the trees there.
And that's something I would underestimate, do you know, with a bit of shade is very good, a bit of woodland.
They're funny, aren't they, cattle? Like, I always find if you just stay still, they can't resist being curious about you. They just can't resist coming up to you.
That brown one always roars. That's where when you mentioned the roaring cow, I knew the brown one always roars.
Why does she roar?
I don't know. It drives me mad. That's the seminal bull you can just see through the bushes, do you know?
They look very content, swishing their tails there underneath the trees. When you hear the birdsong on your farm, what is it that you're not hearing that you'd like to hear?
I would like to hear more of the curlew back again. And even 2 years ago, I would have guaranteed you that we would have heard the curlew. I'd probably like to hear the corncrick again, but it's gone since 1982. I would like to hear the corncrick. We heard the skylark again 2 years ago. I hadn't heard it for a while. We haven't seen the lapwing. So there's three species of birds, do you know, that I've heard but my children won't hear.
And we've come into your bogland here.
Yes. So this is lowland raised bog, important habitat, important. And then you can see the sphagnum moss, the water dripping out of it. So it's a great storage of water. So that's what bogs are great for, storing water, and then they'll release them as well. So when rain falls, it doesn't go straight. You drain them, it goes straight into the rivers, and we've had more flooding and stuff.
So you've just taken a handful of sphagnum moss and you've squeezed it, and it's just squeezed out.
Yeah.
Load of water, and of course, storing water, sponge for carbon.
Yes, and that's growing. As long as you're getting the sphagnum moss growing, then the bog, like you can see, big pools, it's actively growing still.
Do you think in the future you get paid for the carbon storage?
Possibly that is in the future, that could be, but I think it's a way off.
There's a bit of everything on this farm.
There is, yeah, there's a great mixture of habitats. It's just an interesting place to live, and you see something different every time you come out.
That's it, isn't it? Farms as a true labour of love. Ella McSweeney with Patrick McGurn on the banks of Loch Earn. Well, I hope that this morning's programme shed some light on where we might go over the next 2 years with a nature restoration plan and what's going to be needed to bring everyone along. Thanks very much to the farmers who opened up their land to us this week, and to Dr. Catherine Farrell and Dr. Brendan Dunford. Eileen Herron produced this morning's programme. Have a good weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.